So, we are moving on to the Middle Ages. We've sort of tickled the beginning of the Middle Ages, and now we're moving squarely forward. And we'll look at different bits and pieces, including the Crusades, which of course concerned you somewhat. But first of all, what was happening, especially in the spread of Christianity? Last week we talked about how it became the official religion of the Roman Empire and gradually became, slowly, and it took many centuries, became the majority religion. And at the time we're looking at, Christianity is still spreading. By roughly the year 500, most of southern and central Europe, the Levant, that's sort of the area around Israel, and North Africa was predominantly Christian. And Ireland, interestingly, was Christian by this time. There would have been, the odd person here and there who was stubbornly adhering to the gods of their ancestors, but they would have been in a minority. Britain, too, Christianity had rooted itself. However, the Romans left Britain in the year 410. They withdrew the legions because there was trouble elsewhere. And that led to the decline of Christianity because a whole load of pagan tribes, particularly from what is now Germany and further east, started invading. And the Romano-British, if you like, form of Christianity was in decline. In this, it was sort of reintroduced separately in the year 597, when the current Pope, Pope Gregory the Great, sent a group of monks led by a Saint Augustine. Well, he wasn't a saint then. This is not the Augustine who is the church father and wrote a lot of books. This is a completely separate Augustine. But they led a mission to re-Christianize, or they may have thought of they were Christianizing the Britons for the first time. And that's why the head of the English church is, although the center of the English church is in Canterbury, not London, because they arrived at Canterbury. And that's where they set up a monastery and they set up a bishopric and they converted the local king. So that began to spread out again, you could say the second Christianization of Britain. And the larger Christian center, especially Rome, went on sending out missionaries. By this stage, yes, they were missionaries to the Germanic and Slavic and Celtic peoples. Also the Hungarians who were moving in a couple of centuries after we're talking about, the Scandinavians, Baltics. And that process went on to the 13th century. And quite late on, the Teutonic Knights of Germany were fighting various pagan tribes in the area. Now it's really the Baltic states. That's why they were founded as an order, was to fight the heathen and subdue them. Not all Christian areas followed the mainstream form of Christianity that we were mainly talking about, that eventually develops into the Roman Catholic Church. We have various Eastern forms of Christianity that have lasted till today. We have various forms that the mainstream thought were heretical, like Arian Christianity, following the leader Arius, who thought that Jesus was human and not divine. And that type of Christianity actually spread among the Germanic peoples much faster than the mainstream Christianity. And they spent a lot of time fighting that. There were also significant Arian Christian areas in Spain and North Africa. And that really survived till the 8th century. The Monophysites, these are the people who thought Jesus had a single nature, not two natures, which is the Catholic view, but a single divine nature. Those types of churches still survive. The Assyrian Church of the East had split off by the year 400 or so. The Chaldean Syrian Church of India is one of those churches, still a Monophysite church. That originally went all the way to China. The Coptic Church, Ethiopian Church, these are all Monophysite churches still. And then, of course, there were the Eastern Orthodox churches, which now are organized nationally, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Ukrainian Orthodox, and so on. They often get ignored, but they are, of course, very ancient churches. Those ones that we call the Orthodox churches, they were closer to the Catholic Church, and there were times when there was a link between them, but there was a very decisive split in 1054. They have not been friends since 1054, really. So back to number one we're talking about is the gradual Christianization of the Western world and the expanding of Christianity really to a huge area right across Asia and North Africa as well. And this period also, of course, sees the foundation and rise of Islam. So the Prophet Muhammad dies in the year 632. And there was a very, very rapid expansion out of Arabia into the areas of the former Byzantine Empire. Well, it was still the Byzantine Empire, but the Muslims took them over at this point. mostly quite bloodless conquests, actually. They're very, very fast. And it was basically a change at the top. For the first centuries, they wouldn't let anyone become Muslim, actually. You had to become a client of a Muslim in order to convert. So this sort of picture of, bloody forced conquest is actually completely wrong. It was fairly rapid, fairly bloodless conquest and didn't involve mass conversion. Certainly not at the beginning. And so in about the next, I don't know, by 650 or so, most of North Africa and many other areas such as Iraq were increasingly Muslim. And that spreads as well too. So you have tensions between these two new religions, at least new to in terms of Judaism, between Christianity and Islam, both of which are very much expansionist and missionizing religions. There are definitely tensions between them. And the Muslim Empire of the East began it gradually to conquer more and more of the Christian Eastern Roman Empire, what's known as the Byzantine Empire. And that culminated in the fall of Constantinople, now Istanbul, to the Turks in 1453, which is a mega, mega date in Christian history. What else happens in this early medieval period? We have the rise of monasticism, first of all in Syria and Egypt. And there were two types of monasticism. The eremitic, in which the monks lived solitary lives as hermits, and then the slightly later cenobitic type from about the fourth century onwards, in which they were communities who worshipped together and ate together and lived together and worked together. So, again, those two types existed side by side. And the eremitic type was much more common in Egypt and Ireland, and the cenobitic type became more prominent, certainly in Catholic areas later on. And the pattern for Western monasticism was very much set by Benedict of Nursia, who died in 547, known as Saint Benedict, who laid the foundations really by founding 12 monasteries, including the very famous Monte Cassino in Italy, which of course you may know if you know your Second World War history, was totally destroyed, but has been revived as a monastery since the Second World War. And he composed a rule for the monasteries he founded. And the Benedictine rule is still followed by most Western monastic orders, or at least has a very major influence on them. So by the 9th century, really, his rule was adopted in most of Western Europe. And this specified things like 7 prayer services a day. The first one was 2 hours before dawn, and it ended with evening prayer. And many orders still do that. Certainly the Benedictines do, and a lot of other orders like Cistercians, Dominicans. It sounds a bit scary if you're Jewish, but they are much shorter services than ours, if you'll be glad to hear. So, they might only last 15 or 20 minutes, and that'll be a, one that is longer, but they're quite quick. So they're not in there all day. Often there was the rules established a certain austerity. So meat was only to be eaten by people who were ill, and they followed either vegan or dairy diets for most of the time. Work was regarded as a valuable thing in itself. All Benedictine orders, monasteries had, people had to work. They did a lot of their own farming. They were often quite self-subsistent. As people left them land, some monasteries became very rich and actually employed servants. But the original idea was every monk did something, whether it was copying books, whether it was working on the farm, whether it was, extending the buildings. That was part of the life. Monks were required to engage in spiritual reading, what's called lectio divina, or divine reading. And that's still very much a feature is education in monasteries. And this is at a time when not everyone can read by any means at all. So monasteries became centers of education. Educated people who weren't monks often assembled libraries and often were the local place where you could learn. In Western Europe, of course, Latin is the language of the church, as it was with the Roman Empire. And as Latin becomes more and more less of a spoken language and more of a bureaucratic language or a ruling language or indeed an academic language, the monasteries are the way you go to get your information and learn Latin and be trained in that tradition. The monasteries also preserve the classical literature tradition. So, our copies of things like the Iliad and the Odyssey and all the Roman classics often come from monastery libraries. So they weren't just doing religious stuff, which people tend to forget a bit, but they do become intellectual centers. And Benedict's rule also very much emphasized submission of the individual will to your monastic superiors and also to Rome as the center. And again, we tend to forget because the Pope is so powerful. Now, the Pope wasn't always so powerful. Originally, the Pope was the Bishop of Rome. Well, he still is. And he was the first among equals. He didn't have power necessarily over his colleagues. But gradually over time, with the development of various, shall we say, I don't know, power agendas by different popes who have forceful personalities, the Pope acquired more and more power, and the church became more and more pyramidal in hierarchy. By the end of the second century, the Bishop of Rome was claiming to be the most important bishop. Not everyone agreed with him, particularly the Bishop of Constantinople, who, when that became the capital of the Roman Empire, certainly didn't think that the Bishop of Rome had any precedence over him. But under popes like Gregory the Great, who not only sent off his colonizing mission to England, but did many other things, he died in 604. He was very much somebody who increased the power of the papacies. And another later pope, Leo the Ninth, who became pope in 1049, also set out a large reform of the church, but simultaneously strengthened the pope's hold over the church and all its local branches. And this sort of strengthening of hierarchy contributed to that split I mentioned before, the Great Schism of 1054, when the Greek-speaking eastern part of the church finally really broke apart from the western Latin-speaking part of the church. And obviously there were linguistic and cultural factors here too, and also theological beliefs, different beliefs about the nature of the Trinity. But it had been building up for many, 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 many years. So I'm going to pause there and have a little look and see their questions. Some are, the Ben has asked, before Islam, about 600 CE, why didn't Christianity spread eastward in Eretz Israel? Because there was no Roman Empire in Iraq and Iran. It was under different management. It was under the, by this point, the Sasanians. And it would have been quite, there were Christian minorities, definitely, but the Sasanians were Zoroastrian, and they weren't going to tolerate a large and powerful Christian population. It was fine if you were a small minority and knew your place, but it wasn't ideal conditions for propagation of a religion. It's notable that Christianity only takes off really when it becomes an official religion, when it's seen as advantageous. And you might say, well, I want to be a judge. You know, I'm a bright person coming up and I know everything and I want to be a judge, but I'm not a Christian. They won't let me in. I'll convert. So, which is again the reason why Islam spreads a lot. People can't get further up the tree unless they convert. So that was a later factor in increasing conversion. And, you know, Jews sometimes converted to Christianity or Islam. I know we don't like to think about it, but they did. And some of them will have been because that was the way you got on. You got further in life if you identified with the main religion. So in the areas not ruled by the Romans, where Christianity was not the official religion, there was a lot less impulse to actually convert. The moment it becomes what everyone else is doing, it's much more attractive and it speeds up the process no end. Okay, so we're going to move on to the Crusades. Bit of a trigger for everyone, I think. Let's just look at the background. Why did the Crusades happen at all? What were they about? So we said that Muhammad had died in 632, and by 638, the Muslims had conquered Jerusalem, which at the time was under Christian Byzantine rule, the Eastern Roman Empire. Christianity continued. It was a tolerated religion by Islam. Islam had no problem with people of the book, the Ahl al-Kitab, which includes Jews and Christians, and a couple of other religions possibly. A little bit of argument about who else is a people of the book. So nobody was really persecuting Christians for being Christians. But basically, the fortunes under Muslim rule went a bit up and down. It depended who was in charge of your local area, very much like Jews, actually. For instance, in the year 1009, the current ruler of the Holy Land, the Christians, ordered the destruction of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest Christian site, but it was rebuilt in 1039. The one you see now is not the original one. So it depended who was around, much more than what the actual religion that was controlling the area said. Again, if you had a ruler who didn't think it was a good idea to persecute his subjects, he would be left alone to get on with it. If you had a particularly fanatical ruler who didn't like other religions or felt they were undermining the position of Islam, then you might have much more trouble. It depended. In the West, we saw the church was growing stronger and more powerful. On the political side, the Carolingian Empire, which covered much of today's France and Germany, had disintegrated by the 9th century, and the pagan populations round the edges of Europe, the Vikings and the Slavs and the Magyars in Hungary, had become Christianized and were forming states of their own. One result of this was once you've converted all the pagans, you have a large warrior class with nothing very much to do, except in Spain, where, of course, after the after the Islamic conquest of Spain, the Christians from the north spent the next several hundred years fighting the Muslims till they drove them out in 1492, along with us. So that was a very long process, what's usually called the Reconquista. And as you probably know about the golden age of Jews in Spain, there were many periods under both Muslim and Christian rule where Jews did very well. And there were definite times when Christians, Muslims and Jews lived together quite peacefully, cooperated. Some of the great translation work was done in Spain between Jews and Christians and Muslims. And a lot of literature was transferred to Western Europe in Latin via that process, with members of different religions collaborating on translating things. So the Spanish didn't have so much problem because they had, you know, they had a local enemy who their military class could have a go at. But elsewhere in Europe, yes, there were all these knights who, you know, the local rulers didn't really want them to fight each other. So it was quite advantageous to divert them to somewhere else. At the same time, the Eastern Byzantine Empire was facing a threat from the Muslims because they are taking over more and more of its territory. And the emperor located in Constantinople is more and more on the defensive during this time. And there also was, at this point of the Middle Ages, there was a huge rise in religious feeling and popular piety, partly because of the contemporary clash between the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, but partly also for other reasons of greater education, the foundation of some of the wandering monks, like the Franciscans, technically friars, not monks, who weren't permanently in a monastery, but wandered around, did a lot of educating and preaching, and stimulating popular piety and stamping out what they saw as superstitious or pagan practice. So all these factors together make it much more likely that there's going to be armed expeditions against the people who are perceived as the enemies of Christendom. Now, the Gospels are quite clear that Jesus preaches the ideal of turning the other cheek, which, however you interpret it, is definitely some sort of non-violent ideal, though there is one verse in which he says, "I come not to bring peace, but to bring a sword." So again, if you wanted a text, there was one on either side. But later Christian writers, notably Augustine of Hippo, that's not the British Augustine, the other one, developed a theory of the just war. And that naturally included war against non-Christians. This has been debated over the centuries. Various types of peaceful alternatives have not got so much traction. Depends when and where again. But generally, Augustine's idea of justified violence in the name of religion was accepted, and popes gave their blessing and encouragement, for instance, to those fighting against the Muslims in Spain. So the time and the conditions were ripe for a channeling of Western military forces towards the East. And it was promoted as a religious war against the infidel in order to recapture the sacred sites associated with Jesus's life, which had been lost to the Muslims. And individual crusaders would vow themselves as crusaders, and they would receive a cross from the hands of the Pope or his representative, and they were thenceforth considered as a soldier of the church. And it was generally believed that anyone who participated would be forgiven their sins and go straight to heaven. So, you know, yeah, your usual, you know, if you do this, you get off scot-free. And so if you're a sinner and worried about your afterlife, many people were, this is a very good way of working it off. On a popular level, the First Crusades unleashed a wave of impassioned, personally felt pious Christian fury that sometimes was expressed in the massacres of Jews that accompanied the movement of Crusader mobs throughout Europe, as well as the violent treatment of schismatic Orthodox Christians of the East. So it was not just the Jews who suffered from the Crusades, nor yet the Muslims. All the Crusades were pretty notorious for killing off Eastern Christians as well, who were just regarded as no better than Jews and Muslims. So there was a huge amount of massacring of fellow Christians during the Crusades. There you can see all sorts of quite contradictory moments here. For instance, during many of the attacks on Jews on the route of the Crusades, local bishops And Christians in authority often did make attempts to protect Jews from the mobs because it wasn't in their interest. Christians often either protected Jews or offered them sanctuary in churches or Christian buildings or sometimes the local bishop's castle. It depended where, and it didn't happen everywhere, but it was not a one-size-fits-all thing at all. So let me just pause here and deal with Christians. The Franciscans didn't start till the 13th century. Indeed, but even before them, there were wandering preachers. Okay, so I'm talking very general terms. I agree, they weren't before the Crusades. But this idea that you had to educate the public and root out their heretical ideas certainly had started before the Franciscans. Muslims have a righteous war, indeed, and Martin, yep, and so do we, Milchan et Mitzvah. What is interesting about monotheisms is they often develop justifications for violence against people who don't share their views, which is a bit depressing. Though even people who are as peaceful as Buddhists can manage it as well. Just have a look at various places like Burma, for instance. So unfortunately, I have to say this is human nature, and perhaps less the fault of individual members of religions, and much more the fault of the human impulse to smash somebody you don't like. So we're going to look very quickly at a sort of table of the Crusades. We are not going to go through this. There were a lot of them, at least 9. And you can see the first one is 1095. The last one is a long time later in 1271-72. And the ones that affected Jews are the first two, particularly affected Jews. Okay, so we might want to look at the first Crusades particularly. We also need to remember that Crusade-like movements happened within Europe. So for instance, internal heretics were sometimes the victims of a crusade. In 1220, there was a crusade against the Albigensians, a group of Christians who were seen as heretical in southern France, and they were often massacred or tortured or possibly made to renounce their beliefs. And they were rather Gnostic, and they did have some funny ideas from mainstream Christianity's point of view. They did believe in an evil creator of the world and physicality and a good, purely spiritual deity. Sounds a bit like Marcion and his ideas. So most of them were wiped out during the crusade against them, and the rest, I think, were dealt with by the Inquisition. There aren't, as far as I know, any Albigensians today. So it was not just an external movement. It was also an internal movement of actually wiping out various people. And several people, Roger Moore is one academic who's written on this phenomenon of the impulse to wipe out heretics, particularly within Europe. He talks about Jews and Albigensians and other people too. So the first one was declared by the Pope in France. Curiously, nothing happened to the Jews in France, but once the Crusaders got to the Rhineland, then that was enormous, and several Jewish communities were wiped out. We'll look at that in more detail in a moment. The first Crusade was successful, if you like. They took Antioch and Jerusalem. Both the Jewish and the Muslim citizens of those cities were massacred. They didn't really distinguish. Several native Christians, as they tended to call the Eastern Christians, were also massacred. And 4 Crusader states were set up, the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And then one of these is a county, I think it's the county of Tripoli and the county of Edessa, and I can't remember, but it's the Principality of Antioch, I think. I just read a 3-volume history of the Crusades recently by Stephen Runciman, which is a little old, but it's still very effective. And I can tell you that all the Crusaders were just horrible, horrible to each other. They were just very untrustworthy people altogether. The second Crusade was sparked off when the Muslims recaptured Edessa. In this one, the Jews of France did suffer. The Crusaders failed in the east. They didn't take Edessa back. But in Portugal, Crusaders retook Lisbon from the Muslims. So again, this was going on the same time. Again, third one, I don't know if Jews suffered particularly in this, maybe in Akko. Akko was recaptured and all its citizens, never mind their religion, were massacred. There was a lot of massacring. I'd say the Muslims did a lot less massacring during the Crusades, but it was an absolute standard response by the Christians. Number 4 was a weird one. It was intended to be an invasion by Europe, but they eventually, what they did was they stopped at Constantinople and burnt it down, and huge amounts of damage were done. A lot of ancient literature that had been preserved, the Greek ancient literature had been preserved, and art and all sorts of things were wiped out in 1204. And the sack of Constantinople is still a live issue in the Eastern Orthodox churches. They have not yet forgotten. The Crusaders tried to destroy the Eastern Church. They tried to impose a Latin-speaking empire and their own church authorities, which didn't please anyone in the East, as you can imagine. Then there were a whole load of little ones that we're not going to go into. Most of them failed. Quite often the Crusaders were wiped out. So the later ones didn't come to anything much. And gradually, and there were massively complex politics here because the Muslims were fighting against each other as well as against Christians. But eventually all those little kingdoms and counties and what have you disappeared, and the Crusaders were finally driven out and lost their last footholds. Some of it involved Cyprus as well. There was a kingdom of Cyprus. It's a very complex thing. You should really read a book about the Crusades if you want to know the ins and outs. But as I said, the ones that affected Jews are number one and number two in particular. Those are the biggies. So we're going to just look at number one and its impact in a bit more detail. So the First Crusade, as we said, was declared by the Pope, Urban II, at the Council of Clermont in 1095. And this is the account of his speech. It may not be word for word, but it's a contemporary account. So as he's speaking to the assembled armies, this is what he's saying. Your brethren who live in the East are in urgent need of your help. This is actually referring to the Eastern Orthodox Christians, if you like, the Greek speakers. So at this point, they're seen as allies. And you must hasten to give them the aid which has often been promised them. For as the most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in seven battles. They have killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. Generally, Muslims didn't destroy churches, so this may not be accurate. Or they may have destroyed one or two. It may have been taken as a generalization. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impunity, I think that's meant to be not impurity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish his everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It is meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God with which I am invested. It was quite a hard sell, as you can see. Also, it does mention Jews. So technically, this is to aid the Christians of the East against the gradual Muslim incursion into lands that had formerly been Christian. This is not, as we saw, really how it turned out necessarily. So the Jews of France were desperately worried, but it wasn't really, as we said, till the crusading forces got to the Rhineland that they started attacking Jews. The Crusaders were made up of several groups, and they all had their own agenda and interests. There were the French Crusaders, who didn't do anything to the Jews. They weren't interested. The Jews, by the way, took huge care to provide them with food and money and sort of bought them off. And then there were bands of followers recruited in Germany. And as the way they went through, many of them roused to a frenzy by the preaching of Peter the Hermit, who was a French priest accompanying the crusade. Many of these German bands were very anti-Jewish, and they were aided by local citizens of the towns who had nothing to do with the crusades, but didn't like Jewish competition in business and didn't like the special protection and privileges that Jewish communities often enjoyed from the local lord, who would see them as you know, a very good group to tax. Often the local lord was the local bishop. So Jews very often lived under the protection of the bishop or the protection of the local count or whatever he was, because it was profitable for the ruling classes and the bishop to have a nice community of Jews who were very much engaged in international trade and could be milked for money. People resented the fact that these people seemed to be treated differently, so they attacked them. And so it was really the German bands who attacked the Jews in particular. And we do have several instances of the bishop trying to protect the Jews, often by bringing them into the bishop's fortress or the episcopal palace. The upper echelons of the church did not instigate or approve of the violence against the Jews, and in fact, sometimes issued condemnations, but that was the upper echelons. Further down, things were different. And we know what happened largely through several Hebrew chronicles from the time, which were written just after the events happened, and record them in considerable detail. So the first attack was at Speyer, and the crusading bands planned to attack the Jews in Shul on the morning of the 3rd of May, which would have been 1095. It was a Shabbat, and the Jews were alerted to the threat, so they davened early and left. I like whether they were so brave, you know, they actually davened, you know, got Shabbat done at the crack of dawn and whizzed back home. And the disappointed crusaders who found the Shul empty just randomly killed 11 Jews who they found on the street. But at this point, the bishop intervened. And here is, and remember, this is a Jewish record. When Bishop John heard, he came with a large force and helped the Jewish community wholeheartedly and brought them indoors and saved them from their hands, i.e. the crusaders and the local burghers, the local citizens. He arrested some of the burghers and cut off their hands. Through the emperor, Bishop John removed the remnant of the Jewish community of Speyer to his fortified towns, and the Lord turned to them for the sake of his great name. The bishop hid them until the enemies of the Lord had passed. So you can see here that it's not a united front on the Christian side. There are Christians who don't want the Jews to be destroyed, not because of tolerance and love for the Jews, but no, these are my profitable Jews, and I'm not having some wandering crusader kill them off. What am I going to do for taxes? I don't think it was, it was not interfaith. It was practical self-interest. But you note that the Jewish author of this says he wholeheartedly brought them indoors and notes that he punished fellow Christians for attacking the Jews. So that's quite interesting. It's a little bit more complex than we often think. However, the great Jewish community of Worms was not so lucky. Half of them fled to the bishop's fortified palace. The other half stayed at home. And a week after Speyer was attacked, local Christians, note local Christians, not crusaders, accused the Jews of killing a Christian, and they produced a corpse as evidence. And then they massacred all the people who'd stayed at home. And a fortnight later, the bishop's palace was attacked and the Jews there died too. And this is one of the instances where the Jews chose to kill their own children rather than have them fall into the hands of the mob. And at least 800 Jews died in Worms, which was certainly the majority, if not the total Jewish population there. The next community was Mainz on May the 27th. And here the attackers were not a haphazard collection of crusaders and burghers and local villagers. Here it was the crusading troops of one man, Count Emicho. He was a local nobleman who seems to have been a little bit odd. He appeared that Jesus appeared to him and promised to make him emperor and help him convert the Jews. So he was the one who started the attack with his own little private army. This time, some of the Jews took refuge in the fortified palace of the Burgrave, the local town head. Others hid themselves with their Christian neighbors. The local bishop, Rutard, had been paid to stay and protect the Jews. But once again, the crusaders, or this group of crusaders led by Count Emicho, prevailed. And here is the chronicle that records what happened at Mainz. The hand of the Lord was heavy against his people. All the Gentiles were gathered together against the Jews in the courtyard to blot out their name. And the strength of our people weakened when they saw the wicked Edomites, code word for Christians, overpowering them. The bishop's men, who had promised to help them, were the very first to flee, thus delivering the Jews into the hands of the enemy. They were indeed a poor support. Even the bishop himself fled from his church, for it was thought to kill him also because he had spoken good things of the Jews. When the children of the covenant, i.e. the Jews, saw that the heavenly decree of death had been issued and that the enemy had conquered them and had entered the courtyard, then all of them, old men and young, virgins and children, servants and maids, cried out together to their Father in heaven, and weeping for themselves and for their lives, accepted as just the sentence of God. One to another, they said, let us be strong and let us bear the yoke of the holy religion. For only in this world can the enemy kill us. And the easiest of the four deaths is by the sword. They're referring to the four deaths prescribed by Jewish law. But we, our souls in paradise, shall continue to live eternally in the great shining reflection of God's divine glory. The women there girded their loins with strength and slew their sons and their daughters and then themselves. Many men, too, plucked up courage and killed their wives, their sons, their infants. It's interesting the women precede the men here. The tender and delicate mother slaughtered the babe she had played with. All of them, men and women, arose and slaughtered one another. The maidens and the young brides and grooms looked out of the windows and in a loud voice cried, look and see, O our God, what we do for the sanctification of thy great name in order not to exchange you for a hanged and crucified one. And it was traumatic, and the line communities were largely wiped out. One presumes somebody survived to give this eyewitness account later on. And a similar thing happened in Cologne. And it's important to notice that the Jewish sources themselves clearly distinguish between non-Jews who protected or trying to protect them and the non-Jews who were responsible for the atrocities. They, at the time, they were quite aware that they weren't all the same. Generally, the violence came, as we said, from peasant bands, followers of the lesser nobles. Many of them actually didn't get very far on the crusade and just sort of stayed within the Holy Roman Empire. And it tended not to be monarchs or bishops who promoted violence against the Jews, as we've seen. So these groups of the lower orders, if to use a Victorian phrase, were often very poorly educated, very credulous, very poorly organized, which accounts for the fact they didn't actually reach the end point of the Crusades, and also their anti-Jewish excesses. But it's clear that their ideological fervor and the reasons for attacking Jews did stem from the crusading message itself, a desire to exterminate the enemies of the faith, even though the church authorities had not included the Jews in that category. In fact, the instigator of the Second Crusade, Bernard of Clairvaux, now a saint, explicitly warned against attacking Jews, not because of an ideal of toleration, but because for him, the Jews served the purpose we saw in the last session. They were living signs representing the Lord's passion. They were there as evidence of the rightness of Christianity and the wrongness of the Jews in not accepting it. So you needed to preserve them as proof. So he didn't really think that you should be killing them. Also, he thought they'd all be converted at the end of time. But even though it wasn't all Christians who attacked Jews, even though there were Christians who protected Jews, even if not for what we would perhaps think was the right reason, the legacy of the Crusades was very much imprinted on Jewish historical consciousness and still is a major, major fact in Jewish-Christian relations. You know, we've got long memories, we don't forget that. And especially as until quite recently, the Crusades were still presented as heroic wars of faith against an inferior infidel. And until Christians sort of cleaned up their attitude a bit to whether the Crusades were a good thing or not, it's pretty hard for Jews to say, okay, you know, well, let's move past that. I think you would probably find among those Christians who were aware of the Crusades, not all of them, you would probably find a much greater inclination nowadays to say they were not a good idea. They were very damaging. They killed lots of people of all faiths and, you know, ended in total failure. However, it wasn't the only impression of Christianity that Jews were left with at this period. And a very interesting alternative view we can find in Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his great law code of 1171. And in the Laws of Kings, we can find something quite interesting. He discusses the ultimate worth of Christianity in Islam, and he generally comes to quite a positive conclusion. So let's look at what Rambam has to say. He says, "Even Jesus the Christian, who thought he was the Messiah, was the subject of a prophecy in the book of Daniel. Quote, also the renegades of your people will exalt themselves to fulfill the vision, but they will stumble." So that's quite an interesting quote to apply to Jesus. Obviously, a renegade exalting himself and stumbling, but exalting to fulfill the vision. So there's sort of some point that some Jesus wanted to make. Could there be a greater stumbling block than this, i.e. Jesus? Paul the prophet spoke of the Messiah who will redeem and save Israel, who will gather all its exiles, who will strengthen them in the fulfillment of the Torah's commandments, while Jesus calls Israel to be killed by the sword, their remnants to be dispersed and humiliated, the Torah to be switched for something else, and most of the world to worship a god other than the God of Israel. Maimonides doesn't think that Christians worship God. He thinks they worship some other deity. He's not quite sure. Or maybe he's very sure, actually. So he sees Jesus maybe as, again, he's blaming him as the root cause of the bad effects of Christianity. But then he says in a resigned way, "But the thoughts of God cannot be fathomed by human minds. For our ways are not like this, like his, and our thoughts are not like his." And this is the interesting bit. All these activities of Jesus the Christian and the Ishmaelite, by whom he means Muhammad, who came after him, are all for the purpose of paving the way for the true King Messiah and preparing the entire world to worship God together, as it is written in Spania, "For then I will convert the nations to a pure language, that they may all call on the name of God and serve him together." So he sees a positive quality to Christianity. He doesn't want to mention it as the first thing that he was in the horrible bit, but he says they've introduced people to monotheism, or some idea that there is one God, even though it looks as though Maimonides is not quite sure it's the same God. But it's a preparatory step for the end of days when all nations will recognize the existence of one God. How will this work? "For by then the world will already be filled with the idea of Messiah and Torah and commandments, even in far off islands and in closed hearted nations where they engage in discussions on the Torah's commandments." In other words, Christians read the Bible. They read Tanakh. So they're talking about our ideas, and it's going to have some effect on them. Some of them say the Torah's commandments are true but are no longer binding in these times, while others say that there are deep meanings to them and that the Messiah has come and revealed the hidden secrets. He's aware of what Christians say about this question of, do we have to keep the commandments of the Torah now that we're Christian? That's quite an accurate summing up of two Christian attitudes. But when the true King Messiah arrives and will succeed and raise them up, all the peoples will immediately realize that they had been taught lies by their forefathers and that their ancestors and prophets had misled them. But they will have done step one of understanding something that was worthwhile because they will have read the Torah and they will have engaged in discussion of the Torah's ideas. So it's not totally negative. It's quite very generous, I think, under the circumstances. The other big question, of course, for medieval Jews was, were Christians idolaters? Some said yes. I think Maimonides is a bit on that side, but not all of them did. And of course, the question of whether you are an Oved Kochavim, a server of the stars, or an idolater, has huge halachic consequences. For instance, it's quite problematic doing business with idolaters. If you look at the Mishnah, Avodah Zarah, and the Gemara on that, there are all sorts of prohibitions about contact with idolaters. So it was quite a burning issue whether Christians were technically and halachically speaking idolaters. And perhaps the most favorable verdict was given by Rabbi Menachem ben Shlomo HaMe'iri, usually just known as HaMe'iri. The Beit HaBechir is his commentary on the Talmud, which actually was really unknown for centuries, but became republished in the 20th century and is now very well known. And he says, even if their faith is different from ours, they do not belong to the category of idolaters. They believe in the existence of God, the Blessed One, in his uniqueness and omnipotence, even if in some respects, from the point of view of our faith, they incur some errors. In our time, in the majority of cases, even if sometimes they share oaths and the names of important dead personages, by which he means Christian saints, they nonetheless do not consider them deities, and thus there is no idolatry. So Hamir's answer is no, they are monotheists. They've got funny ideas, but they're not of the Avodah Zarah. We can't treat them as idolaters. And that's remarkable from somebody who died in the 14th century, who obviously knew about the Crusades and had lived among Christians and knew what Christians did and didn't do and knew their opinions about Jews, but still doesn't want to define them as idolaters. So again, we can see it's a little bit more complicated than you might have thought. I would also say, it's very varied and it would depend enormously on local communities. So we have evidence, for instance, from Rashi's answers to questions as to what have quite friendly relationships with his Christian neighbors. There's one marvelous little Sheila he writes on this he brought up, which is he had Christian neighbors who brought him round little cakes on the eighth day of Pesach because they knew this festival when he couldn't eat flour was ending and they wanted to give him a present for when the festival was over. And he has a terrible problem because you can't own chametz during Pesach. And he doesn't want to insult the neighbors. And, you know, is it permissible? You know, what can he do with this? Or what can he do with them when you say just leave them by the door? Or what's he meant to do? So he actually considers this is one of his tshuvot in the collection. We've got about 300 or 400 tshuvot of Rashi. But the fact that Rashi had neighbors who wanted to bring him round a little chametz stick treat for the end of Pesach is very disarming. Clearly, relations were not always terrible. Sometimes they were, but sometimes they weren't. Jews are in a lot of places. So the last thing we're going to look at today is the question of art. And here, too, we can see our tangled history between Christians and Jews, specifically the art of books. Because religious texts were so important, copies that were made were often decorated and illuminated with gold to emphasize their sacred character. Often there were illustrations of the stories or the theme of the book. And often the color and the materials could be expensive. Real gold was used. Lapis lazuli was ground up to give you a blue color. The pictures were often called miniatures because they're small. And both Jews and Christians decorated their books in this way. Art historians have often disagreed about who actually did the pictures. Was it really Jews doing pictures? Surely not. As you know, the Torah has the second commandment, which says don't make images of God. And that has sometimes been understood as Jews being reluctant to make images of anything at all. Obviously, Torah scrolls were never decorated, but all sorts of other books were. Books that were book-shaped, what's called technically codexes, didn't seem to have this prohibition on them. And if they weren't being used in shul, nobody seemed to be too fussy. Actually, there are also machzorim, which are decorated with pictures. Early book format copies of Tanakh from Islamic contexts only have golden decoration, don't have figures, but that's probably from their Islamic surroundings. In the European Christian world, Jewish books did have pictures and pictures of people. And other elements seem to have travelled back and forth. So you can see here on the left, we have canon tables in the Berry Gospels, a nice Christian book of the Gospels. Canon tables compare the four Gospels and tell you the verses that match up or don't match up, basically. And they often appear in medieval manuscripts, often in this sort of arching pillar work. And here we have a Masoretic list of variations in text, also enclosed in arches. You can see it's a Shir HaShirim, Kohelet. So again, it's arranged by book, lists of differences or Masoretic exceptions in these books. And it looks very much like the canon tables. And probably, artists probably talk to each other. One theory is that Christians decorated Jewish books, that Jews didn't know how to do it. But for various reasons, that seems unlikely. But definitely they have shared assumptions about how you present a book, how to demonstrate respect and reverence to a sacred text. When we look more closely, we can see there are differences. Though Jews don't seem to mind drawing humans, they don't like drawing God. There are about one or two medieval manuscripts where you have a hand of God pointing down from a cloud, sometimes at Sinai, but they're very rare. Christians had no such problem at all, had gone all over the place, usually, you know, the traditional white bearded male with a halo. But so that is a major, major difference. But you might have thought that, yes, you know, commandment number two, here it is, you shall not make yourself a graven image nor likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. You might have thought that would have stopped any images at all in Jewish books. It didn't. Quite interesting. I imagine what people did is what they still do. And they go, yeah, they're not meant to worship them. And graven images is three-dimensional, but nobody said anything about two-dimensional images. And we're not worshiping them anyway. So we're fine. It depended very much on the culture in which you were. In Islamic cultures, Jews didn't take advantage of this generally. There are some exceptions. There's a tradition of Jewish illumination from Iran. But again, in Iran, there was a tradition of figural representation among Muslims. So again, it probably depended very much on what people were doing around you. And of course, there was also the very important principle of hidur mitzvah, of making a mitzvah as beautiful as possible, which meant that things like sidurim and copies of Tanakh should be as beautiful as possible to fulfill this mitzvah and show your respect and love of the text. So here is a 15th century text that says that. Study should always be in beautiful books, pleasant for their beauty and the splendor of their scripts and parchments with elegant ornament and covers. It is also obligatory and appropriate to enhance the books of God and to direct oneself to their beauty, splendor, and loveliness. Just as God wished to adorn the place of his sanctuary with gold, silver, and precious stones, so is this appropriate for his holy books, especially for the book that is his sanctuary, i.e. the Torah. Interesting. So clearly there were medieval Jews who had no problem. We're going to look at one type of book that doesn't have a parallel in the Christian world, and that's the Haggadah. And because the Seder is held at home and not in shul, many Jewish families would have needed a copy of the Haggadah. We don't know much about the sort of bottom of the market basic Haggadahs that ordinary families might have used, but we do have quite a few of the deluxe copies that were commissioned and used by wealthy families because they survived because people handed them down, didn't it? Since they were made for home use and they were commissioned by individuals, they have a very wide range of the way they're decorated. And one of the most famous is the bird's head Haggadah, which you may have heard of, in which some figures have bird's heads. Okay, they are a pair of Jews, a male Jew and a female Jew, making matzah. This gentleman is holding the thing you put holes in with, the hand-baked matzah. He's just going to conceal little holes he's made here. And I'm going to draw here on the work of Mark Michael Epstein, who's written a fabulous book about the medieval Haggadah, which I think I put on the end of this handout, and really you should read it. And he looks at one particular question here, because people have always asked why. Why would you replace heads with birds' heads? And there are all sorts of ideas. It was made in Germany about 1300, so it's definitely in a Christian context. And the way that Mark Epstein looks at this teases out a whole new layer that people hadn't really noticed before. Earlier scholars tended to focus on tracing influences. Where did they get this model from? Did they take it from a non-Jewish book? And that's what people were interested in. And they often assumed that illustrators must be non-Jewish because Jews wouldn't have had access to the guilds, they wouldn't have had access to the training, and how could they have done it? It's a bit of a circular argument. Epstein uses the concept of an authorship, not just one person, but a whole team of people who produced particular manuscripts. And that would include the patron who paid for it, undoubtedly knew what he wanted and gave instructions. It would include perhaps a scholarly or rabbinic advisor who might explain what had to be illustrated and how, and give the illustrator ideas. It would also include the scribe who wrote the actual text, the vocalizer, the person who put the vowels in, who was often a different person from the scribe, and the illuminator, or possibly team of illuminators who would have painted the decoration and the illustrations and might add in bits and pieces on because they thought it looked nice. We don't have any contracts for how these books were produced, so we don't know the exact process, and we don't know how micromanaged they were by the patrons. We don't know. Did the patron check on the book during progress? Again, we don't know, but we can be sure it was a team process, whatever it was. And Epstein also looks interestingly at the iconography, the way in which a story is expressed. And the same story may look different in different manuscripts, you can imagine. Once you have a standard iconography, then variations become very interesting. If they always show making Haggadah the same way, then this one, where suddenly you've got birds' heads on the figures making the matzah, if it's the only one like that, then why? Why is this particular one different? So most of the figures in the bird's head Haggadah do have these birds' heads, but not all of them. And here are two that don't have birds' heads. Here's a bird's head, and right next to them, it's not a mistake, are people who don't have bird's heads. Okay, so earlier art historians suggested that the bird's heads maybe because, you know, Second Commandment, very, very from Jews, didn't want to shave people. But then you have this problem of, so why these? What's going on here? Can't just be that. There has been a suggestion, oh, Christians who illuminated and they've been rude to Jews, but it seems unlikely a patron would pay good money to somebody who was then going to ridicule him and his family. Seems very, very unlikely indeed. Or that the Jewish patron didn't notice. Oh, my heavens, you know, I didn't even realize there were bird heads. It seems very, very unlikely. He would have been paying a small fortune for this book. He probably got what he wanted. So Epstein has a very interesting suggestion. He suggests that the illuminators were concerned with the Second Commandment, but felt it only really applied in cases of humans to Jews. So it is the Jewish figures who have the bird's heads, not as humiliation, but because they're special. And the Goyim, here we have knights of Pharaoh. Ah, they don't need bird's heads. Why, you ask then, is there this bird's head here? There is Midrashic tradition that Datan and Aviram, the great rebels, were on Pharaoh's side, or maybe the overseers who were Jewish, who oppressed the slaves. So they have bird's heads because these are Jewish figures following the train of Pharaoh. So it fits in rather nicely. And it certainly might tell us something about the way that this authorship viewed its non-Jewish neighbors. Like, not, oh, they're not really human beings. We can show them. Originally it's with blank faces. You can see something that looks like an eye here. That was put in later. So originally they were just blanks. We're not interested in them, just blank faces. So that's quite interesting. A little detail might tell you something about the relationship of a particular patron or an authorship to the people around them. And we'll look at one last example about the relations of Jews and Christians in medieval Spain. We'll look at something very unusual, not very well known. The Alba Bible for 1430s, a bit later. It's unique. It is a Bible translation into Castilian from the 15th century. It was made by a rabbi, but the rabbi was commissioned by the head of the earliest military order, the Order of Calatrava, that was founded in Spain. And they were sort of quite crusade-y, the Order of Calatrava. And this gentleman, Luis de Guzman, who was Grand Master of the Order, commissioned this rabbi, Rabbi Moses Aragel, to translate the Tanakh, the whole Tanakh, into Castilian for him. Very interesting. The order itself was founded in 1164, so it was quite old. It was a cross, really, between an army and a monastic order. And by the 15th century, it was very powerful in Spain. And in 1422, Luis de Guzman issued his commission. Rabbi Moses Aragel had only recently turned up. And he said, yes, I want pictures. I want explanations. I want all sorts of things. Thank you. So at first sight, and the Alba Bible used to be viewed this way. Oh, look, look how lovely, golden age of Spain, rabbis and Christians working together because everyone's interested in the Bible. Isn't that lovely? Example of interfaith cooperation. However, if you pick it apart a little, it's clear that the rabbi wasn't really free to turn down the offer. He did try. He pointed out his religion didn't permit him to be involved in any project that would show God in human form, and that the Christians would obviously want that in the pictures. But he was ordered by Luis de Guzman to begin the project, which took him over 8 years, by the way, to translate the whole Bible into Castilian. Two Christians were appointed as censors to oversee the rabbi's work. The main one was a Franciscan. He, in turn, the Franciscan, issued detailed instructions to the rabbi. So it was a Christian-supervised, sort of almost forced translation. And Luis de Guzman's letters to Rabbi Moses assured him he was going to be paid, but he doesn't seem to have been paid. And this cost him a fortune. Can you imagine? 8 years. You know, he was working on this and nobody paid him, poor man. Maybe the local Jewish community were feeding him. We don't know. It's not at all clear whether the illustrators were Jewish or Christian, but Rabbi Moses clearly had a hand in shaping the 324 illustrations because some of them reflect Midrashim. That's quite interesting too. This is the opening of the picture, which I think really says the whole thing. This is showing showing the commissioning of the Bible. We have the Grand Master Luis de Guzman here. And right at the bottom, this little figure here, holding a book, that's the rabbi. He's at the bottom of the picture. Everybody else is higher than him. Okay. Top person, if you talk about, you know, power and hierarchy and height, top person is Luis de Guzman with a convenient angel above showing divine approval. Then his second in charge. Then there's a whole load of the knights of Calatrava who are doing the seven works of mercy, apparently to newly converted Jews. They're giving them food, giving them drink, giving them shoes, clothes, visiting the sick, consoling the mourners and burying the dead. On one side, there is a Franciscan. That's the Franciscan. On the other side, there is a Dominican under religious supervision. And down the bottom, there are more of the knights with this distinctive red cross is the cross of Calatrava. And they're all standing with a lot of swords around the kneeling rabbi who is presenting his translation to Luis de Guzman. That says something about the power relationships that were going on in this Bible. Okay, so this is not necessarily lovely, lovely interfaith cooperation. I mean, it would be very nice if it was, but I don't think we could say it was. So the very existence of that Bible, I think, somehow encapsulates the contradictions of the time of this tangled history where, yeah, there was cooperation, but what sort of cooperation was it? There were friendly overtures, or there were surprisingly charitable assessments of Christians as not being idolaters. There were also massacres. There were people giving each other cakes across faith borders, but then there was also people commissioning expensive translations, not paying somebody because they didn't have to really, did they? So the whole thing is complex. And if you really want to know how it works, you would have to go down to the granular level and saying, what was happening in each place? Very much like we said for the development of Christianity, Judith Liu's idea that you have to look at what was happening at a specific place and time, because it's not a blanket process. And that's very, very true of the Middle Ages too. Probably the whole of human history, actually. I've put a list of various books here you might like. Robert Hazan's is the classical one about the First Crusade and the Jews. And he's written another sort of general one, which has a lot of the original documents that you'd need to read to understand it fully. Mark Cohen's Under Cross and Crescent, The Jews in the Middle Ages, compares Jews under Christianity and Jews under Islam. He concludes that Jews had it marginally better under Islam generally, but he looks again at a lot of original sources and the legal position in both cultures. And then this is the Mark Michael Epstein, The Medieval Haggadah, which I cannot recommend highly enough. Basically anything he's written is fabulous. So I'm going to stop the share there. Let's look at the chat, which we have to do quickly. Now Christian Nationals are waging this war. Yes, indeed. Why is the Pope in France? Oh, he moved around a lot. Pope traveled all over the place as necessary. Who ruled the four states? Well, they were all French noblemen. And theoretically, they were appointed by the Pope. They tended to fight each other like mad. They all produced dynasties, and there were lots of dynastical marriages and lines dying out and people invading and what have you. It's unbelievably complicated, but they were almost all of French origin. Massacre of the Cathars, can't tell you anything about it. I have read about it, but you want to read people like Robert Moore and other people on that, really. Immediate Mission of Sins. I don't know if the Pope was desperate. You could get immediate remission of sins for all sorts of things that the authorities wanted you to do. You know, various prayers, if you chanted them X times, you got remission of sins. It depended. And then, of course, later on, one of the things that sparked the Reformation was the Pope selling indulgences. You could pay money and get yourself remission of sins. They also promised at one point golden crowns and a seat next to Jesus. I expect that was all over the place. That's certainly an image from the Book of Revelation, so that's probably a generic thing. Isn't believing Jesus as a human god idolatry? And again, Hameiri probably regarded it as very much equivalent to the Muslim concept of shirk, which is the association of figures who aren't divine with the divine. So they just said, well, the Christians believe in God. They just got this extra figure on the side who that's just, you know, a bit extra, but it's not really idolatry because they know this guy was a human. I imagine that's what Hameiri is thinking. Again, it depends. Is it Avodah Zarah or not? Again, you have to define Avodah Zarah very carefully. And there are certain aspects, and there are various medieval philosophical arguments that certain things are permitted to non-Jews that are not permitted to Jews. We're not definitely permitted to associate anyone else with God. It's not clear that non-Jews are not permitted to do this association of other figures. I mean, they're wrong, but it might not be forbidden for them. So you'd need to look at the philosophical justifications of this. And you need to read different people because different Jews came to different conclusions on that Avodah Zarah question. Miniatures. Yes. Oh, that's right. It really comes from Miniare to paint red, not really from its size. You're right. Reminds the golden calf. Not sure which bit does, but yeah. Birds that have got a possible inspiration for mouse. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised at all. And there's a nice recommendation. Signs of Wonders, 100 Haggadah Masterpiece. It sounds great. No birds heads, but also pretty blank faces. Yes, that's what we're looking at. And yep. Any other questions? Ask now or forever hold your peace because we have cut this one.
No, we're okay. We're okay. I have permission. Okay. I have permission to keep the recording running. No one has to leave. Everyone can stay on.
So let's just see any other questions.
Yeah. So you're fine. You can take your time. You can leave when you're ready and everyone else can stay on and grab a drink. Everyone is, there's no pressure, no pressure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question about this, the last one? In the early 1400s, somewhere between the 1390s and the expulsion in 1492, there were mass numbers of Jews who converted, sometimes because, just like German Jews did, sometimes because they were forced to do it. Is there any possibility that this Rabbi Moses was one of the rabbis that converted?
No. No, he's not recorded as converting. There are rabbis who converted and actually rose up and became bishops. So we know quite a lot about, particularly in Spain, we know quite a lot about the Jewish converts. And I was thinking we might do something about that, actually. There were very few converts the other way, notably Obadiah the proselyte, who converted from Christianity to Judaism, but had to run away off outside the Christian part of Europe, because otherwise he would have been killed. But yes, it's an interesting question. Why Jews converted? They often converted and then found out they were still sidelined. That happened very, very often. But some of them rose quite high in the Christian church, especially people who'd been rabbis, because they were learned and they knew stuff. And quite often they dedicated or they presented their rabbinic libraries to the church. Sometimes people's wives would not convert with them. Sometimes they did. There were also cases of people running away because they wanted to marry somebody and converting to do that. So, yes, there was quite a bit of conversion. We like to think that none of us did, but no, quite a lot of us did. Truth be told, I expect if we had, you know, if we did DNA analysis of the whole of Europe, we would find out a great many Europeans. And actually, a huge load of people in Iran. There was a huge amount in this case, in Mashhad, in 1831, I could be wrong there was forced conversion. Forced conversion is often, mass forced conversion is fairly rare, but it does happen here and there. Again, it varies in time and place, and you need to look at that and take each one on its merits. But generally, it's rare for it to be more than a particular episode in a particular town. It's rare for it to be complete countries. The expulsion from Spain was a bit unusual. About a third converted, a third left. I can't remember what the other third did. You need to read Vine Art on that, on the expulsion from Spain. Again, that was very high levels of conversion, quite surprisingly. But as we know, you have then the Murano phenomenon, where a lot of people, especially a generation or two later, decided no, they didn't want to and got out of Spain. And that process went on for centuries. You know, people moving slowly and imperceptibly, probably largely because the Inquisition didn't think conversion was a done deal either, and was constantly, people forget they think the Inquisition was against the Jews. The Inquisition was against Jews who'd converted to Christianity, was suspected of.
Didn't those who converted to Christianity expect it to last, what, maybe a generation, and then they would just, you know, they were going to wait it out.
Maybe some did. We don't have records of what they felt. Some people may have just been convinced, but some people may have said, my religion can't be true. I'm always the underdog. They must be right. There's some people who seem to have converted for very genuine reasons. There are people who converted because they were frightened. And it would have been varied. It wouldn't have been everyone doing it for the same reason. And people wouldn't have had the same expectations. So again, conversos is usually used as the term for Jews who were still practicing Judaism secretly, but not all were. Sometimes, you know, it took, and their families were thenceforward Christian. It's a very picture. There's a lot of stuff about it actually written, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. By the way, the book I was talking about, this is the one you want if you want Cathars and Albigensians, R.I. Moore, The War on Heresy, Faith and Power in Medieval Europe, which also deals with Jews. That's a very interesting book. And he's also written a book which is tougher, called The Formation of a Persecuting Society. They're both very interesting books. This is the one to start with. Yeah.
Also, wasn't there a theory, and I think this was propagated by Netanyahu, that in fact they didn't, the Christians stopped wanting the Jews to convert because they believed that Judaism is not a religion, but it's a race. And therefore, they really were against conversion, and they just wanted the Jews out, either killed or out, because that was the change. I mean, I imagine you're familiar with that theory.
I haven't actually heard that as a major theory. No, I haven't read Netanyahu's book. That's Bibi Netanyahu's father wrote the big book. I haven't actually read it, so I'm not aware. But I know there's a lot of disagreement with his theories. Yeah. And I'm not familiar with the exact theories. Spain was an unusual case because Spain seems to be in the only place where this idea of purity of blood, limpieza de sangre, develops. Yeah. No other Christian society had it. So if that is a theory, it would be limited to Spain and nowhere else in the Christian world. Yeah.
Was limited to
But
and he believes that that was a precursor to the Nazi, philosophy as well.
To some extent, the Nazi race theories were very much a product of 19th century science or pseudoscience and eugenics. So I'm not even sure if they were conscious of the whole limpieza de sangre thing or whether they just made it up from whole cloth themselves. Again, you'd have to look into the conceptual ideas that underlay that 19th century race science, which wasn't just about Jews, by the way. It was about black people and all sorts of things. Suzanne has written Netanyahu's ideas are controversial. Yes, well, no surprise there, really. You'd need to look and see what's the debate among, you know, historians of the period and who gives credence to what's the theory, because there will be lots of different theories. I'm not up on it enough to really know where the position stands now. But Spain was an unusual case because most Christian societies say they always remembered the current Jews, but the current who had converted, they always remembered and thought of them and described them as Jews. But usually the next generation they weren't too fussed about. So if that person had kids, they often were able to disappear into general Jewish society, and it wasn't particularly remembered against your dad was Jewish or your mum was Jewish or what have you. And we might look at that if we do the conversion thing. I'll have a look and see if the conversion thing would make a good session. And if so, maybe we'll do that next week and have a little look at that. But it is interesting. It's interesting that, you know, it's an unequal thing, conversion in both directions, but it did happen in both directions, which is just fascinating, really.
Rabbi Lindsay,
Yeah, we better stop, hadn't we?
I know we can all keep going. And like you said, you might have to throw an extra session in there, it sounds like. Yeah. I want to thank everybody, and especially Robin Lindsay, for this amazing session. I do see Dr. Simkiewicz has joined us.
Right.
So we're going to transition. We're going to say goodbye to you, Robin Lindsay, and we'll see you same time next week. And we will transition. I invite all of you who are able to please stay on. We'll
have
just
a lovely session.
You too, and hugs to Mayoff. We'll see you next week.